So, from complexity to simplicity, I think that's a natural progression that you, on a retreat or in your meditative life, you begin with the kind of basic work and basic guidelines and the rough stuff of your mind. So the teaching lays out the progression as you begin with dana, generosity, and that's interesting, isn't it? You begin with generosity because there's something about generosity that frees you. It really does, isn't it? When I've got more cake than I can eat, a very rich cake. I was telling the others that when Lompo, we'd go Pindapat and when we were in Hampstead Vihara, and we'd go up Haverstock Hill towards the Hampstead Tube Station, and we'd have our bowls, but rarely got anything. And oftentimes we'd pass the Swiss pastry shop, and we'd slow down, sort of hoping someone wanted to make merit. And then we just sort of float around there and, oh well, carry on. Then my mom and dad came to visit. And I told my mom the story. She said, oh, we have to do something about that. So she bought this massive amount of Swiss pastries and Lompo and I mindfully enjoyed. Interesting, my Lompo Cha was there at the time. And my parents are very, so I really got into something very weird. And, but they came anyway just to kind of check it out. And then they met Ajahn Chah, and both of them didn't trust him because basically they had stolen his son. So, that's the feeling because culturally they're Europeans and had no. My mom's born in 1915, no history of Asian Buddhists, so it was like really, really off the wall. What's this guy doing? And interesting how Ajahn Chah, what he replied to them, he said, your son is now safe. And that was true, because before that I was, I was experimenting with some unwholesome stuff, right? And it's kind of such a good reply. It took mom. Yeah, they came around, of course. They're very happy that I was a monk eventually. A mother maybe always wants her son to have kids or something like that. But anyway, from that's a digression. From complexity to simplicity. So dana first, sila, kind of getting our lifestyle together, getting our relationships together. Because if they're not fairly stable and wholesome, the confusion just preoccupies their minds. Sometimes we have no choice. And then begin to really settle the mind with meditation and start to understand the mind through that kind of deeper and deeper mindfulness. And on the retreat then, like you come from a busy background and then you're not used to sitting so long, it's pretty hard, complex, and pain and so on, but the simplicity is the social structure, and then you kind of work at it in your mind. You feel restless and sleepy and restless and sleepy and then sleepy and restless, and then, but somehow, just the fact that I think we stay with it and we just walk, oh, wow, I just can't get my head up today, or whoa, it's only 15 minutes, another half an hour. And but what we're doing all the time through those difficulties is we are developing parami, the ability to stay with the way things are. And what we're developing is attention on the way things are rather than reacting to the way we want them. And that's very important because we're basically abandoning craving. We might not know it, but we are. Like if your back starts to hurt after a quarter of an hour, you'll stay because, well, that's why we're here, to watch that. And when the back starts to hurt, that's craving. I want to get out of here. I'd rather go for a walk and pick the daisies or whatever. But no, you don't. You stay. And that is the abandonment of craving, even though you're not maybe consciously doing that. And that creates a foundation where the mind begins to calm down. Picking an object of meditation, sometimes you really grab it. You're like, you count your breaths, you do deep breathing just to stay in the game, just to stay here. So, but I think after a while, either a few years or a few days on the retreat, whatever, you like kind of like an artist. I think a good art, you know, whether it's a weaver or a cabinet maker or a sculptor, they all go to simplicity. I think I've noticed that. So I was talking with Venerable Ajahn Vimalo, who is our resident sculptor monk, who is a fabulous artist, and I've known him since he was a layman in Hampstead. And we got to talking about drawing and perspective, and because I can't draw, that's why I'm sort of fascinated by that. And he said he could always do that. And then he showed me some of the, he's doing some Dharma chakras. He's made the molds for them that will be on the entranceway to the kuti that's being built. He's made big molds, and they're from the Amaravati, the exhibit in the British Museum, but from the original monastery in South India. Beautiful work. He's got, I think, five different types of Dhamma chakras, and he's got a 4-foot mold for two pillars. Anyway, it's beautiful stuff. And then we got talking about sculptors, and then he said, have you ever seen Giacometti? I said, I've kind of heard of him. So I looked it up, and you know what? Mr. Google. And there it was. And he said, I don't know if you've seen this, it really stick forms, very, very, very simple. Very. And he says when he sees that, like he talked about the dog, that Giacometti, he said he cries. So as an artist, you know, he just sees this guy's got the line down. He's just got the simple line. It's very, very beautiful. So my favorite artist is Lhompho Samedo. and I, because I've had the good fortune to receive his teaching for so many years, when he says something, I really listen. I say, so why are you saying this now? You weren't saying this 20 years. You were, but it's kind of, and I keep seeing a kind of elegance and simplicity. And now what does he say? It's like this. It's just that. It's like this. That's the result of 50 years of teaching. Yeah. Whoa. Is that all I get? But, you know, what he's pointing to is the ultimate in letting go. It's like this. He keeps emphasizing that. If you've been around him recently, it's like this. And, you know, we've been talking about, yeah, but it's like this. And that's the kind of the ultimate simplicity of the practice, things the way they are, the Tathagata, the such realized. Huh? And you, if you've been practicing for a while, you know, it's like Venerable Vimalo appreciating Giacometti's dog. It's just elegance of it. Just, it's like this. Well, how else could it be? Now, if you take that as a position, then it's a tautology, and then it's like, of course it's like this. How else could it be? 50 years as a monk, what a waste of time. But it's not, you know, it's not a position. It's not like an opinion. It's like, wake up. It's like this. Yeah, but I don't want it like this. Yeah, but it's like this. Yeah, but it's not fair. And you just back. And I think that's what we need to do both. We need to have skillful means that can, for me at least, like body awareness is very important. Really understanding how I can understand my life through the body. Because the body tells me a lot about the moment, the way I'm reacting or whatever. So the body's much more informative very often than thought. Thought quite often is like not informative, it's lying. You know, perceptions can really, really kind of warp things. But the body doesn't really lie, it just says the way things are. So for me, and I think everyone that practices, body awareness is terribly important. And it's just awareness, so it's like this. So if I have the narrative running through my head and I say, yeah, but where is it in the body? It's like this in the body. Then there's an intuition about what to do or what not to do or the way it is. There's a kind of wisdom, isn't there? A wisdom in the energy body. So that's important. So whatever way you can develop it, through yoga, through qigong, through tai chi, through body sweeping, through just awareness of your posture, through the breath, through chakra feelings, all of that is bodily awareness. And it's very important. Otherwise, you have no alternative to thought. You're just always kind of in the thinking mind. There's that. Then there's the ability to actually hold attention on something to really ground yourself. So I've just been playing around with the breath with that idea. It could be a mantra you could do, or just a recitation. Say like the Metta Sutta. Many of you know it. But quite often, if you don't have the line before, you forget the next line. So to actually do it slowly, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright. You slow it down, becomes contemplative, but it really grounds you. But it brings you into the present moment. It's simple, but also profound. And those exercises are very helpful. They both remind you of a direction in life, and they require a kind of obvious attention where, you know, if you lose it, you lose it. You kind of get back to it. So those kinds of things are good. Some people use gathas over and over. So I used, for a couple of years there, in early years in Thailand, infinite patience, boundless compassion. Had so much rubbish to work through. And just infinite patience, boundless compassion. Infinite, and just kind of constantly repeating that to myself in a way which is quite helpful. So I had something to turn to, which was in thought, but it was just a limited structure of thought, and it evoked something quite good in me. So those ways of practice. Visualization, I don't really visualize things. It's not part of my conditioning. I never really worked at it. So some people can hold, like we have what we call kasina meditations, where you hold you might draw a blue circle on the wall or a green circle, paint it in, and not on this wall. Nick won't be happy. And you look at the image, and you hold the after image in your mind. You look at the image, and you hold just the image in your mind as a way of stilling the mind. Called kasina meditation. The principle is the same. You're taking an object and you're holding attention on the object in order to be present to the way things are. But at some point, you'll really have to let go of objects, don't you? Because all objects are still sankhata, they're still sankharas, they're still conditioned things. And your curiosity moves, I think, quite naturally to the sense of the doer. And, well, what is it? What is unconditioned? What is not changing, what is not born and not dying. And that is a natural kind of curiosity where the mind turns to the mind. Attention turns to attention. Attention turns to the very sense of being a doer, doing something. And that's very quieting. When you intuit that and begin to inquire that way, it's very silent. Because as soon as you pay attention to the doer, it's empty. There's no doer. There's just empty. Still presence, still rightness, still knowing, but there's no sense of me doing something to achieve some other thing. And that's, I think, a natural kind of progression. And then Lompa's statement, I think, is really the final statement. It's like this. You don't really even need to do that, because you've seen through, you've seen through the whole, you see, the whole sense of self is just a thought. It's just a perception in the mind, like I'm a hopeless monk. I'm a great monk. That's just a thought. So when I do something, like when I was building a little table for chanting the Patimokkha, it looked really good, and then I over clamped it and I popped the whole thing. And what was the perception? You idiot. And it was really very, oh, no, it's a worse thing. No, this is what disappointment feels like. It feels this way. And then that self-disparagement, I am, da-da-da-da-da, that falls away. But then the other, someone praises me, oh, Bhante, well, nice talk. I said, yeah, you're right. No. This is just, it feels this way. You're always coming back. It's just like this. And that always brings you back to the purity of awareness and peace and non-grasping. It's like this. So, And I think this is not like just a, it's not, it's cyclical, I think, isn't it? Like you kind of get to the same places. Oh yeah, okay, this is pretty complex. I better just do something really to settle my mind down. You go to the heart, or, you know, you really got something going against someone. Yeah, yeah, oh, may you drop dead. No. May you be well. May you be free from suffering. You know, you go to those places. Why? Because you've learned them. You know, you've learned about yourself. You've learned about the stuff that overwhelms you, the dangerous places of your mind. And you've learned techniques and intuitions to help you get back to the center. And when you're back to the center, you really find, well, there's nothing to do right now. It's just the way it is. And you begin to appreciate that silent emptiness, that non-doing. So it really, really depends. And a retreat's just a sort of attempt at all of us just to kind of clear stuff out. And guys like me just to try to make some suggestions. But really, it is something about you understanding your conditioning and which area of the kundas preoccupies you too much, where your attention is preoccupied so much that you can't realize the unconditioned. It's usually through thought, and the thought's quite often driven by emotion. So, like, diagnosing the thought, coming to the body, kind of gets you around that.